thank you very much for making it out and not fearing the snow. For anyone who wants to be able to receive these sheets in advance, I'm glad to add you to the email list. Just let me know afterwards. Is this audible? I feel like I'm farther from the mic than usual, but I'm not sure why. Okay? All right. Good. So last time around, we talked about dibuks, and that led to discussion about supernatural things in general, and the soul, and life after death, and so on and so forth. So I figured this time around, let's talk about the soul, and you know, what exactly it is. Anybody know the Hebrew word for a soul? Neshama. Anyone know any other words for it? Neshama is the most popular one, but as we'll see, it's not the only one. Sorry? Ruach, very good. Ruach is indeed another one. Yeah? There's another one. Oh, no. I send them out on condition that you won't read them. Yeah, you are quite correct. There are actually five different terms. For those who looked ahead to source number 9, you'll see 5 terms for it. You could have impressed me and just rattled them off. I might have guessed, but if you look at the first side first, I want to show you something that I found fascinating. It's the theory of 21 grams. Anyone ever hear this? It's an old idea that the soul actually weighs 21 grams. Yeah, that you could actually you could weigh it. If you take a look at source number 1, you find an account of somebody who tried to test this, going back almost 100 years ago. Enter Dr. Duncan McDougall of Haverhill, Massachusetts. The doctor postulated the soul was material and therefore had mass. Ergo, a measurable drop in the weight of the deceased would be noted at the moment this essence parted ways with the physical remains. It is a unique way to lose weight. Dr. McDougall, seeking to determine, quote, if the psychic functions continue to exist as a separate individuality or personality after the death of brain and body, in other words, wanting to figure out whether the soul goes on after the person dies, constructed a special bed in his office, quote, arranged on a light framework, built upon very delicately balanced platform beam scales, sensitive to 0.2 ounce. You know, today that doesn't sound incredibly precise, but for the 1920s that was pretty good. He installed upon this bed a succession of 6 patients in the end stages of terminal illnesses, 4 from tuberculosis, 1 from diabetes, 1 from unspecified causes. You know, also, not a huge trial. But on the other hand, it's not so easy to get, you know, everything you need to get in order to do these experiments. So he observed them before, during, and after the process of death, and measured any corresponding changes in weight. He then attempted to eliminate as many physiological explanations for the observed results as he could conceive. Out of 6 tests, 2 had to be discarded. 1 showed an immediate drop in weight and nothing more. 2 showed an immediate drop in weight which increased with the passage of time. So now they're gaining weight after death. They swore they weren't eating. And 1 showed an immediate drop in weight which reversed itself but later recurred. And even these results cannot be accepted at face value, as the potential for experimental error was extremely high, since McDougall and his colleagues often had difficulty in determining the precise moment of death, one of the key factors in their experiments, right? That's a whole other problem in this experiment. So, and you can read the whole article, you know, there on the website that I gave you with the source. No, we don't actually, within Judaism, believe that you can weigh a neshama, that you could weigh a soul. Jewish tradition says that it's not a physical entity with mass. But the question really is, you know, so what is it? What is a soul? So, Marjorie was kind enough to say that you shouldn't speak until I'm ready for you to speak. But generally speaking, I'm ready from the beginning. So I'm, I'm fine with that. What do we mean when we refer to a soul? What is that? Yes?
A spirit.
A spirit? Does that explain it?
No.
I mean, it's another word I can now ask you. So what do we mean when we say a spirit? I don't know. Yeah?
I think it's very intangible. So it's something that intangible
okay.
that people possess that helps determine moral conduct.
Oh, boy. Okay, so now we're getting to the meat of things. First of all, it's intangible. Second, people possess. I want to come back to that because I'm not sure what that means. And it helps us make moral decisions. Okay. Yes, and then.
All right, I think most people think of a soul as something unique to each individual.
Something unique to each individual, in the sense that it's something that only is different for each person. That's what
that
you mean?
That it determines something about themselves, their true sense.
So it's not just a spirit that may help you make moral decisions, for which everybody could have the same one, but it's something that's unique to each person in the sense that it has characteristics that make you you. Interesting. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with anything, because really, until we, you know, dissect one, we won't know. But we'll see some sources on this. Yeah. Okay, that which makes us human and which makes us closer to the eternal. Let's go back to the first one first. What makes us human? In what way does it make us human? What does that mean?
Our thoughts, our feelings, everything that encompasses what that lady said, who we are and how we feel about being human as opposed to animals. I don't know.
So would an animal have an animal soul or no soul? Dog owners may have an answer. I mean, these are real questions, and they're very old questions. This is an ancient question. The other piece of what you said, it is associated with God in some way. We also have to come back to. There was a hand here, and then I'm going to come back here. Yes. When you say it is faith, you mean that belief in it?
That you believe in it, yes, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I think having a soul is synonymous with being empathetic because some people are described as soulless.
So now you open up a whole other can of worms, which is the way that we use the term soul as distinct from what it may have originally meant. Whereas we use the word soul to refer to a type of music. It has gained meaning within our lexicon because of the things we associate with it. So that takes us into a whole other realm, which I'm not going to get to today. We'll be singing. Yes.
I think that the soul is thought of as life. If you don't have a soul, literally don't have a soul, then you're not alive. You're dead.
So it's what gives a person life, brings a person to life. Okay, what about animals then?
I'm game for animals too.
Okay, no, that's a fair answer. That's a fair answer.
Why not?
Marjorie, and then I'm going to move a little bit ahead with it.
If the soul makes you supposedly moral and gives you a presence, what about a criminal person? A person who becomes a criminal, are they born with a criminal soul, or does that disappear from it?
If a soul is really something from God and something that helps you make moral decisions, then how does a person sin? Does that mean they don't have a soul? Does it mean it got outvoted? You know, does it mean, you know, they got Donald Trump's soul by accident? Like, what? I'm an American, I can say whatever I want. So, I mean, these are all couple of questions. I looked in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, and it says that the soul is the immaterial essence, animating principle, or actuating cause of an individual life. The immaterial essence, animating principle, or actuating cause of an individual life. There's an or in there. So I'm not sure if that means that they're saying there are multiple definitions, or that the soul could, there are different kinds of souls. I'm not sure exactly what they mean, what they're trying to accomplish. But they tell you the essence of a person, that which animates, meaning it brings to life. The actuating cause is very similar to that idea. So maybe what they mean is that it's simply that which brings a person to life, gives a person the ability to exist. But there's more. There has to be more. Because if we take the view that a soul is actually, something that is more than just an animating spark, more than just what brings a person to life, then we have to ask certain questions. Is a baby's soul different from an adult's soul? No, you say no. Well, why is it then that babies don't have the same level of thought that an adult will? If thinking is going on in some connection with the soul, then babies should also be able to think on that level. Yes?
But I don't think thinking has anything to do with the soul.
Right. If you take the view that it's just an animating spark of some kind, then this doesn't trouble you. But if it's some kind of moral force, then we need some way to explain that. Not only that, modern neuropsychology has made great advances in terms of figuring out the way in which the body and the brain control a person's behavior. So that now we've identified genes for things like risk-taking. Right? Or even for altruism, for moral behavior, they suggest that that's something that can be traced genetically. There are always debates, and there are papers being written, and studies being done, and so forth. But between genetics and hormones and enzymes that are circulating within a person's system, we've discovered an awful lot about what causes people to do the things they do. And it's not necessarily soul-related at all. So, again, for those who take a more expanded version of what the soul's job description is, you have to ask yourself, what do we make of today's scientific discoveries? So I want to go way, way back with this. I want to go back to the beginning. If you take a look at source number 2, the creation of man in the Torah, from the first chapter of Bereishit of Genesis. And God said, and this is, I'm using Rashi's approach to these verses. Rashi, the classic biblical commentator from the 11th century, because there are many words in these sentences that admit of multiple translations and multiple explanations, and just to provide something coherent, I chose to work with his commentary. So that's what we have here. And God said, "Let us make man in the image and form," Hebrew words are tselem and demut, In the image and form we have designed. And he will rule over the fish of the sea, and the birds of the heavens, and the beasts, and the entire land, and all of the crawling creatures that crawl upon the land. And God created man in his image. In the image created by God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. That's the initial description of the creation of human beings. But then, in the second chapter of Bereishit, the second chapter of Genesis, we get another account of the creation of human beings. Take a look at number 3, please. And God formed the man, dirt from the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils the spirit of life. And the man was a living spirit. And for man he did not find a help opposite him, and God settled a deep sleep upon the man, and he slept, and he took one of his sides and sealed the flesh beneath it, and that of course becomes Eve, Chava, correct. One note, I translated what it was that God took from him as his side rather than his rib. The word in the Hebrew is tzela, tzadi lamed ayin. Tzadi lamed ayin in modern Hebrew does tend to mean rib, and you can find references biblically to it that way as well. However, the word tsela is frequently used biblically not to mean rib, but to mean one's side. So, for example, the Torah portions that are currently being read in the synagogue these weeks describe the creation of a big building. Anybody know what that was called? The Mishkan, right, the tabernacle the Jews traveled with in the wilderness. And when it describes the sides of the Mishkan and what they were made of and their dimensions and so forth, each one is called a tsela. It's the same term. And based on the way the sages understood this story, I understand tsela here to mean his side and not his rib. But in any case, two accounts of the creation of human beings. What are the differences between these two accounts? There are huge differences, right? But what are the differences between the two? In other words, the version in source number 2 is from the Torah's description of 6 days of creation. This happens on day 6. However, when the Torah gets to the second chapter, it gives a little bit of a rehash, and it talks about the creation of the Garden of Eden and the placement of human beings into the garden, and as part of that, it tells us again about the creation, but there is a substantive difference, between number 2 and number 3. Yes? Right, so one is that in source number 3, in other words, the second version of creation, it mentions specifically God breathing into his nostrils the spirit of life. In the Hebrew, it's Vayipach Be'apav Nishmat Chayim. He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. In Hebrew today, the word to breathe is Linshom. Linshom, a breath is a nishima, and the word neshama is from that same root. So it is a breath. Good. That's one difference. The first one didn't mention anything about a soul at all. It just said, God says, let us make him. And here's his job description. And then God created it. It doesn't say anything about a soul per se. Yeah, so any other differences? So, quite possibly, a spirit of life, living soul, nishmat chayim, could be the soul. Yes?
He created the male and female together in the first instance
of
the second one.
Right. You notice how in the first version of it, it says, male and female, he created them. But in the second version of it, it's Adam first, and then no match. Okay, fine. So I'll create Eve, Chava. It's presented quite differently. What else? It's interesting to see that in the first one, in source number 2, we find God simply create man in this special image that he has designed for man. Whereas in the second version of it, in number 3, man is created as dirt from the ground. And then God puts into him a soul. It's a two-stage creation. I think that matters. One more note, which you wouldn't be able to tell from the English, but the Hebrew speakers will appreciate this. In number 2, when it describes God creating, it says, and God created man. I deliberately translated that verb, and God created man, differently from the translation in the beginning of number 3, where I wrote, and God formed the man. In Hebrew, the one that I translated, and God created man, is Vayivra, Bria, the term for creation there. Whereas in number 3, and God formed, it's Vayitzer, Yitzira. Two different terms, Bria and Yitzira, which is going to matter. Anybody know the term in Hebrew for a potter, somebody who works with clay? Sorry? Give you a hint. In the poems that are sung at Kol Nidre, Yom Kippur night, there's a classic which uses this word in the title. Ki hine kachomer biyad ha yotzer. Biyad ha yotzer. The yotzer. A yotzer is somebody who forms things from existing material. That's what yitzira is. Vayitzer and God formed. There's material and God shapes it. As opposed to Vayivra, the first one used in source number 2, Bri'ah, which, if you think back to the beginning of the Torah, Bereshit bara Elohim, that is a more pure form of creation. It is understood by biblical commentators that that's referring to something from nothing, simply bringing into existence. So that number 2 is talking about creating something new. Number 3 is talking about manipulating materials in order to form something. Yes?
Why is number 2 referred to Hashem in the plural forms? And the third one, it's in the singular. Was that purposely done? Or was it a transition? Were the angels helping in number 2?
Right. So this is a really good question. You've already provided one of the answers the commentators give. The language in source number 2 is, first of all, in all of this, number 2 and number 3, God is described as Elohim. That's the name that's used for God. Elohim literally means powers, plural. So that it is a plural word. You catch the im ending. That's an ending in Hebrew that often denotes plural. So one approach that's offered is that it's simply the royal we. It's God saying, us, our, we, when he's referring to himself. And that does explain in number 2 the multiples. However, various commentators, going back a very long time, noted that it's applied inconsistently. Like you noted in number 3, God is suddenly referred to in the singular when it says he took one of his sides. The verb in number 3 is vayikach, not vayikhu. So God is described as acting in the singular and not in the plural. So some have suggested that when God says in number 2, and he says, let us make man, God is actually arranging a meeting of sorts of the angels and saying, hey, let's have a conversation. Should we or shouldn't we? To which, of course, the question is, well, why does God need a meeting? Right? Doesn't he, have veto power anyway? Who exactly is God having a conversation with? And so the sages take it in multiple directions. One approach is to suggest that it's a conversation of God, so to speak, among his attributes. Meaning there are things that God values in this world, and he's weighing. Are human beings going to further my ends or counter my ends? And so God says, well, from the perspective of truth, maybe I shouldn't create human beings, because they have problems with that one. And then on the other hand, God says, from the perspective of generosity, human beings are kind and giving people, I should create them. And he actually goes back and forth between the sides, and that's being conveyed with let us. There's another commentary which suggests that God is trying to teach us a lesson, which is, always consult with others. Even if you have the power to do something yourself, it's appropriate to consult others. And he says, I'm going to consult also, have a meeting. All of these different explanations are fundamentally catching exactly what you caught, which is the inconsistency of the pronouns, where God is sometimes referred to with a singular, sometimes referred to with a plural, and they're trying to figure out, what is this trying to teach me? Whether the dry answer, which is, it's not teaching me anything, it's simply that Elohim is a plural word, or whether it's something that's trying to give me a deeper and richer understanding of creation. Yes?
I find it interesting that at the end of this paragraph 3, It says, and he sealed the flesh beneath it. Would that have a connection between the neshama, the soul, and the flesh? What is the connection? Why do we say flesh? So then we don't define the flesh is something that we can say, but the neshama is, we can't define it. If he sealed flesh, Elohim.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, but I think it's just in the context of the surgery being described. In other words, he took one of his sides, and then it continues, vayisgor basar tachtena, he sealed the flesh beneath it because he just took something out of the man, so now he has to close him up.
But that was only the neshama, there was no flesh, maybe.
Well, at this point, there is no, because this is when it says that God formed the man dirt from the ground. In other words, it's a physical form. He's a human being with a body at this stage. Yeah, that's the way I understand it. It's an interesting point, but I think that's the way to read it. So, we have two accounts of the creation of human beings, and we have differences between them. Right? We've noted here, among the differences, different verbs used for creating. In the first one, in source number 2, Adam and Eve, male and female, seem to be created together, whereas in number 3, it's Adam first, and then Eve. Right? There are substantive differences here. In the first one, in source number 2, the human being is simply created, whereas in number 3, it's a two-stage process. He's formed, and then a soul is put into him. Now, you could figure out ways to read this and to solve those problems individually. So, for example, when it says male and female, he created them, maybe it means as a species. It doesn't necessarily mean that right then God created man and woman. You could say that. But the commentators came up with other approaches, and I brought you in source number 4, one particular approach written by Rabbi Moses Nachmanides in the 13th century in Spain, and reflecting an idea that we find earlier than him in the Talmud. Nachmanides writes, "The initial creation was of male and female, including the soul. But the formation," meaning the second account, "was a formation of the man and building of the side into the woman, as would be told in the end," meaning in chapter 2, in source number 3. Therefore it said, Briyah, here, in the first one. And below it said, Yitzirah. Sorry, that's my typo in there. Below it said, Yitzirah. One who is insightful will understand, he says. Which is a classic approach of Nachmanides. He likes to do that. He'll provide you with a couple of sentences and then say, go figure it out. That's his approach. So, he suggests that the first account in which male and female are created is actually the creation of the neshama, the creation of the soul. And the original human creation is of a soul which incorporates male and female. One body, two souls. And that what happens after that is God says, you know, that doesn't really work. And he splits them off. And that's the image of taking the side and making somebody different and investing that second side as Chava, as Eve. If you take a look at source number 5, you find among the Talmudic bases for Nachmanides' idea, Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar said, Adam had two faces. That does not mean he was two-faced. I mean, two faces. This fits the text. He created them male and female. So the idea is that initially human beings are male and female in a single body, and then God splits them off. Have you ever heard of the nice idea that that when people get married, they're finding the other half of their soul? Comes from this. This is the basis for it. So, within this, we find, aside from a lot of very interesting discussion about men and women, and there's a lot you could do with that, and the question of, so when they were two souls in one body, who went first? You know, things like that. Separate from that, we find here the initial reference to a soul. In this biblical account that we're commenting on, what we saw in number 3, we find the statement that God forms the body and breathes into it the spirit of life, and that is this soul, this image that God creates for human beings. However, someone used the phrase before when explaining what a soul is. Someone said, it's something that we possess. And I think that's actually an important turn of phrase. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Is this familiar? The Modeh Ani prayer, traditionally said when one rises in the morning. And my translation here, I thank you, living and enduring King. You have returned into me my soul with mercy. Your faithfulness is great. So there's a lot that could be said regarding this prayer. This is not a simple prayer. I had a mentor of mine who I remember vividly telling me this about 25 years ago, maybe a little less. He told me a story about how when he was a kid, his rabbi was, he said there were two things about his rabbi in Cheder. One was that he was brilliant, and the other was that he was drunk. But to make a long story short, his rabbi once said to him, his rabbi once asked him, "Did you say Modani this morning?" And he replied, "Yes." And his rabbi says to him, Yiddish, "Du bist a Lügner," which means, you're a liar. I don't even know much Yiddish, but that much I know. So he said, he says, "Du bist a Lügner." What do you mean? You don't know how to be Mode. You don't know who Ani is. And you surely don't understand Lefanecha. What's he talking about? So Mode is the line of thanking. When it says, "I thank you," to be Mode. Ani is I. And Lefanecha is when it says in the Hebrew, I didn't translate it in English, it doesn't translate well, but literally Mode Ani Lefanecha means I thank before you, in front of you, God. Which, there's a lot of depth to that, and maybe sometime we should go through this prayer and understand what exactly that message was about. But what I wanted to show you here is his point about not knowing who Ani is. When it says, "I thank you, living and enduring King, you have returned into me my soul." What does that suggest about the relationship between me and my soul? Two separate things. Two separate things. My soul isn't me. Because if my soul really were me, God would not have returned my soul into me. It is me. Wherever it's been while I've been sleeping, it's me. It's not, if anything, I'm thanking you, God, for returning me to my body. But that's not what it says. There's a different conception here of the relationship between soul and individual. I'll give you another example. Source number 7, a blessing that's traditionally recited every morning. Elokei Neshama. My God, the soul you have placed into me is pure. You created it, you formed it, you blew it into me, and you guard it within me, and you will take it from me and return it to me in the future. The soul you have placed into me. I am not my soul. So it appears. Standard liturgy. The message that I draw from this is that the body and the soul... the body and the soul together have cognition. Together they comprehend. There's a sharing going on between the body and the soul. It's a hybrid. They work together. And it's not that the soul is a person's consciousness and the brain and the body is a piece of clay. But there's actually something cognitive, something that understands in the body, independent of the soul, and they work together.
But it's only on loan.
Sorry?
It's only on loan.
Only on loan, yes. Well, that's the other piece of this, right? Where it said, you guard it with me, you'll take it from me, you'll return it to me in the future. Right. The reference to returning it in the future is a whole other class about Tchiyat HaMeitim, the idea of the resurrection of the dead. Maybe one day we'll get to that one. But this is an important idea. The idea that there is a functioning brain and body separate from the soul and they communicate with each other. But that goes back to some of the points that I raised earlier. The question of, if the soul is a thinking, intelligent thing, why doesn't a baby express itself intelligently? To which we can now offer a suggestion that it's because there's a communications breakdown. The body isn't up for it. There has to be some kind of avenue of communication, even within the body itself. There are times when the communication will break down, right? If someone has a stroke, then their brain can be thinking but not able to express itself. There's the remarkable case of Scott Routley. Anyone here ever hear of Scott Routley? Scott Routley was in some kind of, call it persistent vegetative state. He had a study done on him at Western University a few years ago. And it was a remarkable study. They used a new technology, then new technology, called fMRI. And what they discovered was, even though they thought there was no thinking going on and no perception whatsoever, what they found was that when they showed him movies, his attention actually shifted based on what was playing. When they asked him questions, inside the brain there was activity showing he was answering the questions. So for example, they asked him, he had been a tennis player, so they asked him to imagine himself swinging the tennis racket, and certain sections in the brain associated with what one does when one moves a tennis racket actually lit up. So he was perceiving what was going on, and they think that about 20% of patients in that condition actually are able to sense and are just, you know, not functioning at a level where they can respond. The point is that there can be breakdowns in the communication between the body and the soul that will prevent the soul from expressing itself. This idea, the soul inside one's body is not one's entire self, leads us to the next question, which is, so what about me is the soul? If my soul isn't all of me, so then what of me is it? Is it your sense of humor? Does your sense of humor come from the soul, or is that, you know, a body thing? Sorry?
Brain.
If a person is, let's say, really good at math, is that soul or brain?
Brain.
A person's memories, are they soul or brain?
Both.
Why both? No, I'm curious, why both?
I think it's brain.
We know that a lot of one's memory is brain resident. We can point to places in the brain which, God forbid, if damaged, can affect the person's ability to remember. But that doesn't mean it's only there. That just means that there is memory there. I don't know. We can't provide firm, strong answers for any of this. But take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 8. Passage in the Talmud. It's talking about what the parents provide for a child and what God provides for a child. Right? The genetics of a child. So look what it says God puts into the human baby. God gives an infant ruach, neshama. Ruach literally is spirit, breath, wind. Neshama is that term that we've been using for the soul. Charm, which may mean personality. It's a hard word to render. The powers of sight, hearing, speech, and locomotion, and understanding and wisdom. All of these things are gifts from God. That doesn't mean that all of these are the soul. What it means is that all these things are gifts from God. How do I know that not all of these things are supposed to be part of the soul? Look at the line. What does it say? Separates them, precisely. There is a ruach, there is a neshama, and separately there is charm. Separately there is understanding and wisdom. Those are not a function, apparently, of ruach or neshama. They are something else. We are steadily narrowing what's in a neshama, what's in a soul. Yes? Question?
Compassion.
Could be. I mean, they weren't listed separately on here.
Compassion.
the capacity to. And it's entirely possible. I can't say right or wrong. What we have, you know, I'm giving you the sources that I have for it, which frankly so far have not addressed the question of human relationships, sympathy and empathy. It has that hasn't even entered the picture yet. It's possible. Yes?
So does the soul mature and evolve since you're starting off with a baby here? Like, and you said that it wasn't able to be the same as an adult. So
right.
Is it moving?
Does it sound like it's moving and evolving from what we've said so far? I mean, the fact that it goes into a baby doesn't mean that it's going to then grow.
But it doesn't stagnate.
Why not?
Because you said that the baby didn't have the abilities as a adult does.
Right, the ability to communicate between brain and soul. In other words, effectively the soul is there, but the interface to human expression isn't there. That's not from the baby, that's not from the soul side, that's from the body side. Right now, the way I understand it right now is that I don't think it evolves and changes. But I can't prove that that's right either. There's a lot that I can't prove. I can just bring sources that speak to the topics. All of the sources that we're talking about, when we're looking at these pieces from the Talmud and from the Midrash, they're all drawing on biblical verses and trying to say things that are consistent with the biblical text and consistent with the greater canon of what we know from the Torah. But at the end of the day, no one who is writing on this has seen a soul. So it really is a matter of trying to figure out what the text is telling us and doing the best we can with it. Yes?
It's the concept of the evolution of the soul that has changed over time. Because, of course, they're building on sources. But if we go back to the earliest, would there not in some sources be that it seemed that the soul and the body were
from a Jewish perspective, I'm not familiar with any that say that they were one. In fact, if you look at the verses that we saw in Genesis, God breathes it into him. So it's clear that the soul and the body are separated.
When a person died, then the soul died.
Right. Not within... Right. So here you're touching on a separate important question, which we might do as our topic next time. And that is, how does all of this affect our understanding of life after death and the independence of the soul from the body? You find biblical sources that attest to the idea that the soul continues after the body dies, but you don't find anything that is in any way, shape, or form explicit about where it goes and what it does. Just that it continues to exist. And we'll see. You know, if Marjorie's okay with it, then maybe that'll be the topic next time to talk about that. But right now, we are definitely seeing the seeds of the idea that the soul and the body are in fact independent, and that when the body dies, there's no reason for the soul to cease. You know, the body can exist without a soul until God breathes into it, and the soul is an independent agent. Exist, not live, but exist. In other words, the body is formed. It's it's formed from the dirt, and then God breathes into it. Let's take a look at number 9, because number 9 is only going to make this worse. A very old Midrash, from the volume of Midrash called Breishit Rabbah, which is one of the first works of Midrash to be canonized into a formal text, going back about 1,800 years ago. And it says, it, referring to the soul, is called by 5 names. That there are 5 names used biblically to refer to the soul. Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Yechida, and Chaya. I did not bring you all of the verses that they use as their source for each of these. I only brought the job descriptions given for each one. Nefesh, which some of you may have heard used for the soul, and it's most famous now for what?
A child, a newborn baby,
a nefesh. Well, a nefesh isn't... A baby has one, but...
Pikuach
nefesh is a term in Hebrew for saving a life. How about in Hatikvah? right? Nefesh Yehudi, right? The Jewish nefesh. So what is a nefesh? Well, according to this midrash, nefesh refers to the blood. It isn't something that is non-physical at all. It's the person's blood. Where in the world do they get that from? So there I did leave in the verse. There is a biblical verse, Ki hadam hu hanefesh. One of the many times when the Torah prohibits us from eating blood, it says, Ki hadam hu hanefesh. Hanefesh. Because blood is the nefesh, therefore it's inappropriate to eat it. So, this nefesh may be called a soul, but it's something very physical. And they know it's physical. No one is under any illusions of thinking that blood is some kind of a spiritual entity. What you're seeing here in this use of nefesh as some kind of element of the soul is a recognition of interaction between the physical and the spiritual. And yes, in this sense, it's a soul and body that are together. Ruach refers to is that it ascends and descends. Meaning goes up to heaven, comes down, and they quote a biblical verse from the book of Ecclesiastes. Who knows the ruach of humanity, whether it ascends upward or whether it descends below to the ground? What that verse from Ecclesiastes means is way beyond what we're going to do right now. That's code for I don't know. Neshama, they tell you here, is the mind. Yechida. Anyone know what the word yechida means? Separate from our discussion here?
Group.
A unit. Good. A unit. Echad in Hebrew is one. Something that is miuchad is special. If you know the song from the end of the Seder, Chad, well, Echad miyodeya is good, but Chad gadya, one goat. Yechida is that all other limbs have multiples. And this, meaning the soul, is unique in the body. I guess the nose has nostrils, and you know, you can figure it all out. But that's the suggestion. Chaya literally means alive, right? A living thing. It is used for animal from the same idea of the living thing. Chaya is that all of the limbs die, but this stays alive from the body. Which is an explicit reference, obviously, to the soul persisting here in the Midrash. And again, each of them draw on biblical verses to support their ideas. My point in bringing this is not so much to do an analysis of each one, but rather to show you the complexity of the idea and the fact that they're thinking about this question of, so what is the soul, and coming up with multiple aspects of it. Whether in terms of thought, whether in terms of life, its intersection with the body, the soul is not something simple. But I think what does emerge from all of this is that the most basic definition of a soul is that it is an animating spark. It's what brings a person to life. And to go beyond that and say, it is a person's thoughts, it is a person's sense of humor, it's a personality, it's a moral thing, yeah. All of that gets us into areas of speculation that are really very hard to certainly to prove, but even just to trace back to earlier sources. There is a recognition that a lot of what people tend to think of as the soul is actually body dependent. There's a whole lot more to say still. So I'm gonna move ahead a little bit with it. Where does the soul come from? Well, we've already seen the idea that God breathed the soul into the human being. In source number 10, I brought you a passage out of the Talmud that speaks to the resemblance between the soul and God. And I'm not going to go through it here because there are some other things that I want to make sure to get to. But you can see it there in number 10. That there are five parallels between the soul and God that the Talmud points to here. But what I wanted to make sure to get to is the idea of the purity of the soul. It was mentioned before that the soul, you know, is a person's moral guide. There is an idea that the soul is from God, and coming from God, it is pure. So if you take a look, well, we already saw a reference in that Elokai Neshama prayer in source number 7, where we said, God placed a pure soul into me. And that's found Talmudically. There's discussion about the soul and its purity. In source number 11, I brought you a quote from Don Isaac Abarbanel, leader of the Jews of Spain, right before the expulsion from Spain, in which he says, he compares, he says, clothing honors a person and leads him before the great. And when clothing is dirty and stained, then, he quotes the biblical verse, go away, impure, they declare. And people cannot go before kings without removing the stains by washing and purifying them via great blows and wringing, the way you did laundry in the 15th century in Spain. He says, the clothes give honor to the person who wears them, and if the clothing is made dirty, then you have to launder it. He says, so too a person's deeds are the garb of his soul, in which he appears before the universal king. Therefore, he must have good deeds. As the verse states, at all times your garb should be white. In other words, your actions can be good or bad. Your soul is untouchable. It may become unworthy because it's wearing dirty clothing, so to speak, if a person's actions bring it dishonor. But fundamentally, the soul cannot be touched. And that's one school of thought. You'll be shocked to hear that not everybody agrees, that, you know, there's a dispute. Because, you know, when did Jews do that? If you take a look at source number 12, Rabbeinu Yonah, 13th century Spain, says the following. With physical illness, sometimes an illness lightens, and most of the affliction heals. But the body is not cleansed of it, other than by drinking bitter potions and suffering the pain of withdrawal from desirable foods. Right? Sometimes an illness will just recede on its own, but a person needs medication in order to really be healed. So too, the soul may be ill from a great transgression. And even though most of the illness will be healed, and the multiplicity of aspects of punishment will leave once one repents and Hashem retreats from his wrath, still, the soul will not be cleansed of the illness, and her sin will not be fully forgiven until the sinner has suffered. Now, I'm not getting into the question of punishment and repentance and so forth, as fun as that discussion is. We have like 5 minutes. But what I bring it here to show you is that he seems to believe that when a person sins, it is the soul itself that has been corrupted. And that's what I wanted. He talks about the soul needing to be cleansed of whatever it is that it has experienced. So there really are two views about whether this animating spark that God puts into a person is pure or is not pure. But that brings us to the big question. Yeah?
Are all the souls the same?
So a lot will depend on what we've said so far. It's a good question. Are all souls the same? Going back to the idea from the beginning that a soul may be unique to each person. If I take the view that it's just what God sends to bring a person to life, to animate the body, then there's really no reason for them to be different. However, in much of Jewish tradition, there is the idea that souls are unique and different, and that there are souls with greater potential and souls with lesser potential, souls that have been through the ringer a couple of times and souls that are here for the first time. There is an idea of souls being different found in certain sources, but I could easily support, based on what we've said so far, the idea that no, it's one size fits all, and every time somebody is born, God will take a new spark, animate that person with that soul, and that they won't be any different. You could support either view. Yes?
And just
about
the translation.
Yeah.
I don't
know how
it's done, but it's a person.
Yeah. Right, so the answer is, the word in Hebrew that we've been using most often that is used there for the soul is neshama. Neshama is masculine or feminine? Feminine. Neshama is a feminine word, absolutely. And so therefore, when he writes there in the Hebrew, it's actually her, is the term that he uses. It's not because there's a sin there. The same thing would be true if it was a merit. It's but yes, the answer is that the word in Hebrew, neshama, is a feminine word. Sorry?
Does that mean men don't get any?
Yeah, the men have no soul. No. What it, remember that in Hebrew in general, there is no neutral gender. Everything has a gender, is the way the language is formed. So this is simply the gender of the word neshama. Mystics, I assure you, will do much more with it than I am. But that's my answer. Yeah. So that's what we're going to have to discuss next time. We'll have to discuss that one next time. This is like an infomercial. We keep bringing you back. The answer is it's for next time because, yeah, that's a whole... This discussion is really... What number 7 is referring to is Tchiyat HaMeitim. That's what it's talking about. It's the ultimate resurrection of the dead. So it's talking about something which... You know, requires that we first ask before we get to the soul coming back, where does it go? And we have to get to that conversation. We did it a little bit last time when we talked about the Dibbuk. So we did have some discussion of it, but it requires more analysis. I'm not necessarily going to get to answer the question of so how does a person sin the way we're going. So maybe that will be the beginning of next time. We'll do that because I like taking the questions. They're good questions. Yes.
I was raised with the belief that all the souls will be born when Mashiach Explain that.
While standing on one foot. The question is asked. You know, what of the idea that all souls will come back when Mashiach comes? So I would say two things. One, going back to the question that was just asked before, is that it really is something we have to discuss next time, as you know, to give it proper treatment in terms of what is this idea of the soul persisting after death? Where would it go? What would it do? And why would it do it? But in terms of the specific point about Mashiach, there are different schools of thought in terms of what a time of Mashiach ushers in. Maimonides writes about the time of Mashiach in a very rational way. He says Mashiach is a human leader who is going to lead the Jews in the service of God and is going to throw off their enemies. And the only difference between this world and the time of Mashiach is that there will be no more tyranny from the nations over us. Very straightforward. Others look at Mashiach's time in supernatural terms and more along the lines of what you're talking about. Even Maimonides recognizes an ultimate resurrection of the dead, but he doesn't associate it with Mashiach. It's a separate era, which comes later than that, called Tchiyat HaMeitim, the time of the resurrection. But I think what we're going to do is hold that really as the next time's topic, because there's no way to discuss it in any depth now. I'm taking one last question. Arlene. Yeah, absolutely. I know that was where I was. That was really what I was trying to do before when I said a soul, as I understand it, based on what we're saying here, could really be explained as an animating spark, that which God sends that invests in a human being to bring that human being to life. For that matter, as this goes, one could understand that animals also have, on their level, some kind of spark that brings their body to life just as much. With its own powers and with its own form. But the idea there is not necessarily to connect it to personality and memory and sense of humor and all those other elements. I don't think one has to say that those are there within the soul. I think based on what we've seen here, it seems like there is some kind of separation between the soul as an animating spark and the other traits. Having said that, there are sources that understand the soul to be more complicated, to be something that has what we tend to associate with personality, memory, relationships, and so forth. There are those who will assign to the soul also the idea that each soul is unique and each person has a different soul with different capacities and different traits. I certainly don't mean to discredit those, but I think what I've shown you today is a reasonable school of thought based from the biblical verses and from the sages of the Talmud and the Midrash, showing that one could take the soul as very simply the means with which God brings the person to life, an independent thing, which, when the body ceases to function, will then persist and continue. There is much more to say. Please do take me up on my offer, that I've made before. My email address is at the top of the pages, and it's fine. I am very happy for you to email me questions and thoughts afterward. Marjorie, when am I back?
April 12th.
So we have a choice between discussing Passover or discussing life after death.
Life after death.
Life after the Seder. Okay, so we'll... God willing, we will continue then.